Welcome to Season 3 of Swiss Impact with Banerjees. I'm Sveta.
And I'm Ben.
The topic of Season 3 is Impact Investing, the New Normal. Do you also want to do something meaningful for our planet and people, or invest with impact?
Then our amazing and powerful guests who are business owners, heads of financial institutions, thought leaders, political leaders, policymakers, investors, and experts.
Greetings, my name is Ash Pachauri, and I'm the senior mentor of the POP, or Protect Our Planet movement, and also a member of the board and secretary treasurer of the World Sustainable Development Forum. Our primary goal is to mobilize the 1.8 billion youth of the world to urgently address the issue of climate change and take action to protect our planet.
This will inspire you to get engaged.
And in this season, we will challenge them even more to take actions towards sustainable development goals, to enable paradigm shift in the financial sector and way of doing business.
Watch and learn how can we, as humans, transform into eco-financial system which would serve all people and the environment.
We aim for impact investment to become available to anyone, become truly mainstream.
See you every Friday at 3 p.m. Central European Time at Swiss Impact with Banerjee.
Act for your future.
Good morning, afternoon, and evening to everyone, and to our viewers from Far East, good night.
Welcome back to week 12 of season 3. Our show is about impact investment. The theme of this season is impact investing, the new normal. To do so, we must shift capital towards true impact, where positive social and environmental changes go along financial return. Of course, impact investing is a force for good and the driving force to achieve sustainable development goals.
Did you know, last week, I was informed by an old friend of mine from Armenia that not only are they watching our shows, but they even started two projects, one on the education of children, and they also started a fund for investing in impact investment projects in Armenia. Can you believe it? This really makes a difference.
Well, of course I believe. And it means that we are indeed succeeding in our objective of raising awareness around the world. And some other good news, maybe you will believe it too. For all non-English speaking countries, they also can watch us soon in their language. At least I can say for sure for Russia. My mom told me today that a registered YouTube user can actually get synchronized translation, and she finally couldn't understand us 100% what we are talking here about.
So everyone who wants to keep informed and support us in this, please subscribe to the YouTube channel that's called Swiss, www.youtube.com/Swiss Impact.
Of course, and also the ones who want to learn about profitable business with impact, how to do that, we will conduct 3 more trainings in the next 3 months. Check chamomile.ch and take the opportunity to learn about impact investing and profitable
and
business.
And I forgot to mention, we are also available on podcast and on smart TV.
Wow. Yeah. Everywhere soon. Hope people will not say, oh, they're everywhere again. Okay. Ben, but before we invite our guest, would you share a little story, maybe positive or whatever, however it will be today?
No, I'll just summarize a short article I wrote a few days back. I was very utterly shocked when I heard that the Amazon forest destruction or deforestation has increased significantly. In fact, the Brazilian Institute INPE that monitors Amazon from the space last Thursday mentioned that between August 20 to July 2021, the deforestation has speeded up. It has increased with 22% more than the 12 months before that. In fact, under the reign of Bolsonaro, the deforestation has been increasing with double figures percentage each and every year. This, despite of all promises and commitments of Bolsonaro.
For all the viewers' information, when we speak of Amazon, we are speaking of the lungs of the planet Earth. And this is why we have 4 questions to you, to our audience. How long should mankind allow such activities to continue without taking any actions? Should we let leaders like Bolsonaro get away with this because they are democratically chosen?
And isn't it time that the protection of humanity, or for the protection of humanity and planet Earth, the Amazon rainforest should be taken away from Brazil and put under the UN protection. And people like Bolsonaro should be followed up by ICC for crime against humanity.
On that note, let's start with our guest today. Previously, we have discussed the global issues like climate change, loss of biodiversity, inequality. And today, we are going to discuss one of my favorite topics, actually, and it is plastic pollution in nature.
So with this, we welcome John Duncan, the initiative lead of WWF, No Plastic in Nature.
Welcome, John.
Thanks, Rita and Ben. Yeah, nice to be involved. Thanks for the invitation.
So John is he's leading the initiative, which brings together a diverse team of people from WWF officers working on solutions to one of the most complex challenges facing our oceans today. John has a background in marine biology. My son wants to go in that direction also, and an interest in sustainability transitions. He previously led WWF's South African Marine Program, where he worked on a broad range of areas ranging from plastic pollution to sustainable seafood and marine spatial planning. I'm very curious to know what that means. He has previously held a seat on the Marine Stewardship Council Developing World Working Group and is a current member of the advisory board for the World Economic Forum's Global Plastic Action Partnership.
Wow, I'm really looking forward to have a cool interview with you today, John, because you have so much to tell us, I'm sure, on the plastic pollution today.
So we start with then the policies and treaties. So John, you are a South African now living in Switzerland. You have had an amazing history till now. From a very difficult and controversial topic like sustainable fishing, you moved to No Plastic in Nature initiative of WWF. Despite of these two seemingly impossible and unsurmountable issues, you still call yourself environmental optimist. Why?
It's a good question, Ben, but I think a couple of reasons. I think, you know, to be honest, I'm also a parent. I've got two daughters, and I kind of don't see any alternative to optimism. I think it's really important that, you know, we do think positively and optimistically about the future, you know, for the sake of our children. And you know, and I've never been inspired by someone who's not optimistic, you know. And I think there's always two ways to interpret, you know, something, you know, kind of challenge or opportunity, and we have a lot of challenges on the planet at the moment. But, you know, I don't think anyone is motivated to change on the basis of hearing how challenging something is. They're motivated to change because, you know, they hear about someone doing something about it, and it's our job to be inspirational to the kind of next generations. So I think that's hopefully why I'm optimistic, because I don't see any alternative, and it's important. And I think, interestingly enough, when you talk about, you know, the difference between fishing and plastic, sustainable fisheries is a bit of my history in a sense, and it's a challenging topic because you're always balancing off people's needs, you know, in terms of fishing communities and the need for protein versus, you know, the ecological needs to try and keep as many, you know, ecosystems intact and keep as much fish in the ecosystem. And so it was often a really challenging thing. You had to kind of people versus nature in some sense. But I think with plastic pollution, it's actually more simple, where, you know, kind of most people, everyone is aligned. No one wants to see plastic in nature. And, you know, so there's a lot more momentum behind kind of trying to fix the problem. And it's not as the trade-offs aren't as difficult. That's why I'm optimistic about plastic pollution as well.
Well, I'm also optimistic. So we are in the same boat, John. Can you please tell our audience of WWF, what do you do and how exactly? So a little bit more of the background, and also please tell us about the activities and mandate of your initiative with the name No Plastic in Nature initiative. Yes.
Sure. I mean, I think at a high level, you know, WWF is one of the world's largest conservation organizations with over 6,000 different employees working in over 100 countries around the world. And that's on a very wide range of topics. including obviously plastic pollution. Within the plastic pollution space, the No Plastics in Nature initiative is focusing really on kind of three key areas, and that is working with businesses to try and help them understand what their plastic footprint is, and recognizing actually that that's not as simple as you might think. For some of these large multinational companies who are active in also 100 or 200 countries around the world, understanding what you're putting onto the market and how each of those different markets manage that like the end of life waste is actually quite challenging, because a ton of PET waste in Thailand is a very different story to a ton of PET waste mm-hmm. in Switzerland. And so you've got to understand that a footprint does really depend on what that kind of fate is in each of the different countries. Then we also work very actively on policy. And that's kind of one of the key pillars. I think that if you don't have policy supporting a lot of this work, you're ultimately going to have a very short-term impact. And your policy has to underpin the kind of long-term direction, both from a kind of environmental perspective, but also kind of financial sustainability. And then the last piece is working with cities through our Plastic Smart Cities initiative, where recognizing that we try as hard as we can in WWF to work upstream as much as possible, because that's where the long-term solutions lie, preventing waste from ever entering the environment. But in some cases, particularly in places like Southeast Asia right now, the challenge with waste management is acute, and that's where some of the highest kind of leakage is happening at this point in time. So we are working with some of the cities in Southeast Asia to try and help work through kind of what a sustainable waste management system should look like.
Before I go to the next question, I wanted to ask, what do you mean by upstream for our audience?
It's a good question, Ben. I think many people are kind of aware of the analogy when it comes to plastic pollution of upstream and downstream, in the sense that the example always used is if you walk into your bathroom and someone's left the tap running and the sink is overflowed and the water is flowing onto the floor and all around. The question is, do you start mopping the floor first or do you turn off the tap first? And I think the answer is obvious.
You never know. Once you face this situation, then you will know what you did first.
No, it's a very old Dutch saying. In Dutch saying, it says that don't wipe the floor, turn off the tap. Yeah.
And so, the upstream solutions are trying to turn off the tap. So, those are things looking at the production of the plastic, the design, something you can either reduce the amount of plastic being put onto the system or ensure that you are recirculating the kind of important plastic within the system through either reuse or recycling. The downstream problems are what to do with it once it's become waste. Mm-hmm. And I think in WWF, we kind of believe that something's already gone badly wrong when plastic has arrived in the environment. Trying to pull it out of the environment is really not a long-term solution.
Yeah, exactly. And because you mentioned policies, and maybe you can give us a peek in your back office. So when you say policies, what do you mean by them? How do you put them together? Mm-hmm. To whom do you present it? And who are the kind of your stakeholders? So how do you properly see to it that the policies are implemented?
Yeah, this is the challenge.
Let's try not to be too political here, right?
Policies.
I think there's obviously multiple layers of policy work, starting right at the top, which is actually one of the big focus areas of our work within the No Plastics in Nature initiative, looking at international kind of regulations, and this is international treaties and agreements around how we manage plastic pollution. And interestingly enough, plastic pollution is clearly a global pollutant, but it's pretty much the only global pollutant which doesn't have an international agreement regulating its use. And so that's one of the things that we are advocating for very strongly at the moment. And that's an opportunity coming up at UNEA, the United Nations Environmental Assembly, next year in February, where there's a resolution on the table for the UN member states to agree to start negotiating a treaty on plastic pollution. And already we've got almost 3/4 of UN member states agree that there is a need for such a treaty. So, and that treaty will help agree on a whole lot of things, how we measure plastic pollution and how we can harmonize kind of responses to it, because at the moment everyone's doing their own thing, which may work in one country but actually cause more problems in another country. So, you know, standardizing certain regulations across the world, and then also creating kind of a mandate for nations to report against progress in terms of stemming the leakage of plastic into the environment. And you know, so that's kind of at an international level, that policy piece. Then next level down is obviously your national policy, where independent states have to figure out how they can actually address kind of plastic pollution within their own borders. And again, you know, each country has a very different waste infrastructure kind of setup and you know, different underlying characteristics. So policies will differ from one country to the next. But you know, some of these policies look at how you finance waste management, for example, and that's where policy tools like extended producer responsibility come in. Or even, you know, some countries have just banned certain types of really problematic plastic. And then,
how many countries ban plastic by now? Do you know them by heart?
A simple answer, Svet, is none. No one can ban plastic. I think, you know, this is really the challenge with plastic, is that, you know, I think the ambition to get rid of plastic altogether is not really realistic and probably not desirable. You know, many applications of plastic are really important because they help protect human lives in the case of COVID, and they help, you know, preserve food and reduce food waste, for example, in certain forms of packaging. So, you know, we have to recognize that they are necessary forms of plastic, but at the moment, you know, there's a lot of unnecessary plastic out there, and that the kind of recycling and reuse systems to help ensure that those necessary plastics don't leak out of the system are not in place. You know, so I think, you know, when you ask, you know, who's banned plastic, you know, there are the bans that we've seen to date are really around certain kind of singular objects. You know, so you might see like coffee stirrers, or you'll see in the EU, for example, now it should be quite difficult to find a plastic straw, for example, because that has now been banned. But, you know, I think you'll still struggle to find in anywhere in the world an individual who doesn't touch plastic on a daily basis.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something on this. It is, especially if you're as old as me, then you will know. When I was a young kid in India, people drank tea in mud or clay cups. You drank the tea in the train, railway stations or whatever, and you threw it away and it broke and it just disappeared in the soil. Today, everybody is using plastic cup. So when you go on the train, the side of the train line tracks are collection of plastic. I mean, you can't believe how horrible that is. So it is not a very old thing. It has permeated our life quite in the last two decades maximum. A lot of these things, and that's what I think you said correctly, the necessary and unnecessary plastic. And this I certainly consider as an unnecessary one. What is happening now in India, that it is so full of plastic everywhere that even the cows and the birds are eating it.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, that's really dramatic. But let me ask you the following question, because we know that we are producing nearly 400 million tons of plastic annually. And also rich countries consume more plastic per person, but due to their more efficient waste management processes, it is actually the poorer countries which have become the source of majority of plastic ending up in the nature, like Ben said, or also in the oceans, of course. And during our previous meeting, you had mentioned the same. Can you then explain what does waste management mean for your initiative, and how and why do you think that impact investors among our audience can get involved and solve or help solving this issue?
Yes, yeah, so I mean that's an important issue, and I think, you know, also something that will be tackled under that kind of global agreement, hopefully. But I think what's really important to understand is that, you know, we don't want to create this kind of dichotomy of developing nations being the cause of the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not a waste management. It's not solely a waste management problem. And I think that that's really important to understand, you know, because the waste management, going back to my earlier analogy, is kind of like, you know, the downstream solution here. You know, like if we just manage the waste better, then we'll you know, have less plastic leaking out into the environment. But we're ignoring the fact then that, you know, plastic is made of fossil fuel, for example, which is contributing to the climate problem. And actually, I think now is a good time. If you could just maybe bring up the slides, I wanted to, you know, share with your audience what the kind of key challenges are with plastic pollution, because I think we often see it through quite a narrow lens. So, you know, I think everyone knows that, you know, plastic is associated with kind of marine pollution. And you can see from the picture here, you know, plastic in, you know, coral reefs and many marine species, over 700 of them, are known to be impacted by plastic ingestion. But the, you know, the interesting thing, I think, that is often ignored, you know, is it's not just biodiversity or marine biodiversity that's impacted. Plastic has a significant climate impact too. And, you know, this is not just also at the in terms of production, but also across its across, you know, its whole life cycle. So many countries, including Switzerland, for example, incinerate most of the waste, and most of the plastic ends up in another form of pollution in our atmosphere. So, you know, the estimations are that between 10 and 13% of the kind of global greenhouse gas budget, essentially, by 2050 could be used up by plastic production, which is why, you know, it's not simply, you know, address waste management in the developing world. We've got to look at this a bit more holistically.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I think that, you know, we also need to recognize is that, you know, plastic pollution has massive economic costs, which are, you know, again, this challenge between developed and developing world, where most of the plastic is produced or developed in the developing world, and the big companies who are selling it tend to be based in, you know, in the developed world. But the countries that are often end up having to try and manage the waste at the end of life are typically in the developing world. And you know, there are massive costs associated with trying to manage it. So you've got, you know, companies who aren't paying the full price of these products, benefiting or profiting off the use of plastic, while, you know, developing world economies are kind of expected to pay the waste management costs, which obviously is also not, you know, appropriate. And that's where tools like extended producer responsibility come in, which I mentioned earlier. This picture, out of interest, is actually in Indonesia, and this is a normal beach.
That looks horrible. You know, I always, when I see that, it's like, oh my gosh, you know.
And this is, I mean, these are the impacts. I mean, you can see there's a fire burning in the background, with sometimes which they start mm-hmm. spontaneously, or other times they will be lit intentionally to get rid of the plastic. But obviously you've got communities living, you can see their houses right there as well, who then get, you know, all of the toxic fumes. And this is actually a fishing community, you know, so you can see their fishing boats there, and you can imagine the impact that this plastic has on their ability to, you know, fish and catch anything in the mm-hmm. ocean. So, you know, highlighting that it's not just, you know, the economic costs of plastic pollution are also quite significant. And this is where it's coming from, to your question of, you know, developed, developing. 75% of plastic leakage in the ocean comes from uncollected waste. And I think that, you know, so yes, this uncollected waste is typically coming from a developing world country. You know, people who live in the developed world can't connect with this, because they understand, their understanding of waste is they put their garbage bin outside their house on a, you know, one day of the week, and then someone collects it and takes it away, and they never think about it again. You know, but that privilege is not afforded to, you know, a large majority of people living in this world, and they have to get rid of those products somewhere. So, you know, the environment is pretty much the only option. There's no alternative. It's not a person choosing to do something, you know, be a bad person and litter it because they could have put it in the dustbin. The dustbin does not get collected. You know, and again, this comes back to the question of whose responsibility is that these people are being sold products that they can't do anything with other than litter it into the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to understand this kind of, I suppose, multitude of challenges that plastic pollution is creating. and recognize that, you know, waste management is not the only solution here. We need to be looking upstream to reduce the amount of plastic that's produced and make sure that those systems exist for both developed and developing world countries that actually ensure that someone has somewhere to put these products once they've used them for the first time.
Yeah. And isn't this an issue that I imagine that you can gain more if the large multinationals will convert or adapt your policies than the smaller companies? Or am I wrong and the smaller companies can contribute also?
It's a good question, Ben. Maybe you can shift the slides away. I think when you look at the balance, it's tricky. You know, I think this is probably the same with many environmental challenges. I think, you know, a lot of people look to the large multinationals to take leadership on the issue, and which I think they rightly should do. And I think that, you know, they are often the most outspoken about things that, you know, like trying to take a lead. I think that we need to hold those big companies accountable, and we do want to see more action from some of those big companies who are often kind of highlighted as the worst polluters in the world. But, you know, in each individual country, you know, you'll have these multinationals that may take up, you know, 30, 40, 50% of the products. But the other 50% is often, you know, smaller or national companies who are often, in a sense, less accountable, because they're not big brands who are, you know, going to be held up in public for their performance. So it's a bit of both. But I think that, you know, we should expect the big kind of companies to lead the way. And that's where, again, that tool such as a kind of a global treaty will help ensure that, you know, everyone has to play by the same rules, and that you don't have free riding of, you know, these kind of national companies.
How far are we with this global treaty, John? When do you expect it to be signed finally? Something like Paris Agreement on plastic, or how does it look like currently?
Exactly, that's a very good analogy. The Paris Agreement for plastic. So the challenge is we're right in the starting blocks, which seems crazy when you consider that, you know, we've had 26 years of climate.
It doesn't sound good right away.
So we haven't yet agreed to that the world needs a treaty, and that's what's happening at the United Nations Environmental Assembly in February next year. But the signs are good that nations will agree to start negotiating a treaty. Once we've got to that point, you know, those negotiation processes can take quite a long time, between, you know, 2 to 10 years, depending on how complex the negotiations are. I think we're hopeful that it won't be that long, and that within 2 to 3 years, we could actually have a kind of agreed upon and ratified treaty in place. So, you know, to 2024, 2025, we could really, you know, start to have some of these things cranking up. And that's not to say we need to wait until 2025 to, you know, take action on some of these other things, but it's just to I think this is that treaty helps to lay a foundation upon which other things also can be built.
I mean, it's a bit like pandemic, right? So if it was concerning everyone, then we suddenly can take actions. Why can't we take actions here quicker? It concerns everyone on the planet. So always, why? It's so obvious we need to take action.
And it is also coming every time you now read in the news and everything that it has breached our groundwater, it has breached our food, it is in fish, it is in meat, it's coming, it has become a problem for the whole world.
Yeah, I mean, and that it is a challenge. I think the question of why can't we take action, I mean, we are taking action, and but the
quicker, John, quicker.
Yes. I feel similarly to you, Sveta, but I think that I mean, the challenge is actually, and this is where I think your audience is really important, because waste management is typically one of a kind of a loss making area or sector. So how do you finance waste management? At the moment, it's mostly financed from people's taxes. So, which is why developed world countries tend to be, you know, manage their waste better because they collect more taxes and they have more money to, you know, put into this problem. But we won't mention the fact that many of these developed world countries export all of their waste to the developing world as
Yes. Yeah. Switzerland does it, by the way, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Switzerland also exports its waste to other countries in Africa and so,
Okay, I didn't know that.
But I think that, you know, the reality is because all, like, you know, the costs of waste management are all externalized, you know, and it kind of goes back to my point about extended producer responsibility, where the producer is not paying for what how you manage the waste of that packaging once the consumer has used it once off, and you know, they kind of walk away with their profits and never have to think about it again. That's changing now, as I think the consumers and governments are becoming more aware of the, like, the problem, and you know, expect more accountability from these companies. But I think that the challenge is to develop policies which kind of internalize those externalities, because that's when people say, well, it's actually too expensive for me to put certain products on the market. And that's where like the world's moving this slowly, but I think you'll know that, you know, finance needs kind of a good policy framework in order to kind of invest in the long term. And, you know, we're starting to get there. But at the moment, the kind of the first movers are really guys who are taking chances or moving because of the public pressure, as opposed to kind of a lot of financial opportunity in this space.
Oh, talking about financial, so then we come to the business side of it, is that you mentioned that you're also working at mapping out plastic footprint. How and what do you do, and what are the business opportunities in it?
Yeah, that's a great question, Ben. So, I mean, I think I talked a little bit about plastic footprinting earlier, and that's really, it's kind of a good plastic footprint has two pieces to it. You know, one is what is a company producing? And then the second part is kind of what's happening to it. And so to take a very simple example, if you've got a company A that's active only in Switzerland and it's only producing plastic, like let's say chocolates, and it's you can say, okay, well it's gonna have it's introducing 10 tons of polypropylene packaging every year onto the Swiss market. In Switzerland, the polypropylene doesn't really have a recycling scheme, so that's likely to end up being incinerated. You can have a very clear idea of its footprint. Compare that to a multinational company which is producing chocolates, beverages, you know, chips, everything else, and it's exporting them or even producing them in, you know, 100 plus countries around the world. Each of those countries, you know, some will have waste management schemes, some will have recycling schemes, some will have, you know, maybe have some form of reuse in operation, some won't have any form of waste management. When you start to put that into the picture and trying to, you know, and you have to add it all together to get that company's kind of plastic footprint, that's a much more challenging picture. And that's also, you know, understanding that, you start to get an idea of, from a company's perspective, okay, well, where do we invest? If we want to have the biggest bang for our buck, we want to try and solve this problem, you know, investing in Switzerland right now for waste management's probably not a, you know, not going to have a really big impact. You know, and that's where investing, you know, in a place like, you know, Indonesia at the moment might make the most sense. The challenge though, as I mentioned earlier, like, you know, investments in waste management, if you are really difficult to see how at this moment without good policy frameworks, how are you going to make a good return? And that's where the opportunity comes in, because looking at the alternative opportunities here. So upstream is really, I think, where the kind of exciting stuff is happening right now. And this is where actually a lot of investment is flowing. So reuse.
So are you talking about circle economy here? So if yes, how do you look at it? And what is the angle of your initiative to this topic? Of course, it's very, very, very closely connected to upstream, I think.
Absolutely. So I mean, sorry, I should have probably clarified. I mean, the circular economy is essentially the foundation of what a kind of the upstream approach is all about. Is ensuring that, you know, you cutting off unnecessary plastics, but then everything else needs to circulate. Anything that we say is valuable and needs, and we need it in our system, we need to make sure it doesn't leak out of our system. And that's kind of a circular economy. And a true circular economy aims to ensure that you're not kind of downcycling things, so that a bottle doesn't turn into a flower pot, for example, which means we need more virgin material to make another bottle. You want a bottle to turn into another bottle. And ideally, if you can, make it a reusable bottle so that it doesn't have to be remade in between each use, then you can also reduce your carbon footprint and further kind of virgin inputs to the system. So, that's the kind of circular economy that we need to be working on. And that's where I think that, as I said, the investment opportunities are right now. So working, refill is one of the big kind of spaces that you're looking at reuse. Recognizing that packaging is one of the biggest contributors to kind of marine plastic pollution. Mm-hmm. Figuring out how you can create refill systems where consumers can get convenient refills. So Ben, I don't know about how we'd have to think about it in your train example, but it's happening here in Switzerland. You see, you've got kind of reusable coffee cups where you get a coffee in it and then actually drop it off at a cleaning point and then get another one later on. And that's there's a massive, like a mushrooming of initiatives in that space, looking at kind of the coffee cup refill opportunities. There's also, as you all have seen, and maybe in some of the stores, where you get consumers have the opportunity to bring their own containers. And not have to take.
I have a fun example on that. I was yesterday in a shop, and then a guy next to me, he chosen to buy a salad, kind of, and then he had two of them, and he said, "Well, why is it? It's exactly the same, and one is 5 francs more expensive." And then the shopkeeper said, "Well, if it's you bring it back, you get this 5 francs back. So then you don't spend. We reduce waste, right?" But the guy said, "Oh, it's okay." And then he took the option not to pay the 5 francs. Right? But unfortunately, because I was like watching, okay, is it working? It's not always working. Unfortunately. But
for some people, 5 francs can be a bit lot of money.
No, he didn't look like a poor guy.
No, I mean, that's a good point, Sveta. And I think that's why I said, convenient. We have to make it convenient, and it has to work. Because, if you are expecting consumers to take the kind of more environmentally responsible action when they're not being kind of forced to from a policy perspective, then the challenge is that it has to work for them.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And one of the things here, I also think that when I go shopping, I mean, in Switzerland, you have these big food shopping places, nearly all our vegetables and fruits are packed in plastic. So I know that in one side, it is good because it keeps the food from getting spoiled fast. But on the other hand, a large part of it, or basically nearly all of it, ends up in the waste. So do you see here also a role played by businesses to somehow work on it? And will your initiative from WWF would like to be consulted or be involved in such business ideas?
Absolutely. So I mean, that's where this question of kind of eliminating unnecessary plastic comes in. And trying to determine which parts are unnecessary and which are not is kind of the first challenge. So we're involved in groups of business groups working on this challenge in multiple countries around the world through kind of initiatives called plastics pacts, where you've got often government and business and NGOs working together to kind of work out a kind of a roadmap to solving some of these problems. And one of the first challenges they have is to identify what those unnecessary plastics are. And unfortunately, it's more difficult than you would think. So, the common example used is often around cucumbers. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't understand why they're all wrapped in plastic.
Now he's going to explain it.
So, my attention is all yours.
Yeah. So I mean, a cucumber that's wrapped will typically have a kind of a lifespan of up to 11 or 12 days in your refrigerator, whereas one that's not wrapped will last 3 to 4 days. And so when you think about environmental impact, you need to consider kind of the overall what went into production of that product as well. And in many products, you know, the footprint of the environmental footprint, 95% of it is generated by the production of that product. And only about 5% is related to the packaging of that product. So, you know, getting rid of the plastic on that product because you want to try and make the world a better place, you could be fixing the 5%, but making the 95% far worse. And I think that that's the challenge of trying to figure out where we need to intervene. But I mean, by the same token, you know, Ben, when you walk into the shop and you see a plastic product wrapped in plastic, wrapped in more plastic with another piece of plastic, you know, that's where you say, well, geez, something's definitely gone wrong here.
John, do you know what? There's another issue in here, because the freshness or nutrients are from vegetables and fruits, you're losing every day. So the longer you keep it not fresh, right? So the nutrients inside are also decreasing. So keeping it 11 days at the end, I don't know exactly how much percentage you still have, but then the tomato doesn't smell like tomato, doesn't taste like tomato anymore, especially in winter. So is it worth it at all to keep it so long then? Because you know what I mean? I'm from a farm. I grew up in the village, so for me, tomato must smell a tomato. Otherwise, I don't eat it at all.
Now, John is regretting that he came to the TV show.
No, I think it's a valid question. I think it's a complex answer, though, always, because I think you know, I would first prize is to buy locally. You know, buy regional things that are not transported long distance and are not heavily packaged, and you know, use it, and you can use it tomorrow. You know, you don't have to store it for a week, you know, but often that's a privilege that, you know, not everyone has, and I think you can look at many of the products that are arriving on the in the developing world context, where they just do not have access, they don't have the cold chain supply chains that can actually deliver a product within days of it being, you know, picked, kind of thing. So I think, you know, yes, if you can, is the answer. But to many people, you know, their options are much, much more prescribed. And in that case, you know, having something which is nutritious and partially nutritious is better than having something that's not edible at all.
You're absolutely right, John. Of course, I understand this problem as well. But I just want to maybe reach out to those who can do that and still not doing it, right? Yeah. So it's always, if you can do it, then at least do it if you can, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, but
I think Ben's point was up front in the show was to say that, you know, the developed world are actually producing more plastic waste than or more waste in general than the developing world. You know, and that's to your point. Actually, you know, the first place to start is just use less.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's what we also do. Another point is that a couple of weeks back we had another guest. And she mentioned, because she's in textile, and she mentioned that every time we wash our clothes, we are releasing enormous amounts of microplastics in the ocean. And this is the plastic which we do not see. So we have this large plastic floating islands on the top of the ocean, as is visible. Or we see them dumped in the lakes in Asia and Africa, which you are speaking about, which you also showed in the picture. But how do you look into microplastics, and which also the so-called developed world is also dumping into the ocean?
Yeah, microplastics is one of those kind of even newer than the kind of idea of, or the concept or concerns around plastics, is this kind of realization that we have this issue of microplastics, and the sources of microplastics are really diverse. So you mentioned, you know, washing coming from, you know, clothes, the polyester, those kind of fabrics. But it's much broader than that. And actually, one of the biggest contributors to microplastics is from tires. So wear on tires on the roads. And I think that, you know, when you start to think about how you can address that kind of a problem, it's really challenging. And I think, though, you know, without causing too much alarm, you know, although obviously microplastics have been found everywhere, from, you know, the top of Everest to the bottom of the ocean to inside animals and even humans, that we don't yet have a really good idea of the impact of these microplastics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to say that we should not worry about it. But I think what, you know, at this point in time, kind of, we're still trying to figure out what those impacts are. But what we do know is that a large percentage of microplastics also come from macroplastics, the bigger plastics that have been broken down.
Yeah.
And in terms of volume and weight, 98% of the plastics in the ocean, for example, are still big ones. So that's where our opportunity is to really, you know, grapple with the things that we can actually kind of collect and make an impact on, and so reduce the chances of them becoming microplastics. The solutions to microplastics, I think, are going to be even more interesting. And you know, I know there's some research looking into kind of installing filters on washing machines, for example.
Yeah.
But I don't think yet we've got an answer to the question around tires and how we address that.
I was very funnily reading this article a few days back. It was in a science journal about, you must be knowing it, the mystery of the missing plastic. Because apparently they have calculated how much plastic is entering the ocean, but we can only find 3% of it. And somehow they can't find 97%. So they think that it has been broken by the weather, by the water, by the animals, and broken into tiny pieces and dissolved somewhere down deep in the ocean. So they call it the mystery of the missing plastics. You must be aware of it.
Mm-hmm. John, I wanted to continue our discussion on externalities, because you've been speaking on this, I think, more than a decade, on how fossil fuel pricing should be included, like the externalities of it, like damage to the environment, transport, or dangerous gas releases, etc., and also adding prices of water, land, and food use to feed the cattle in the prices of meat. What do you think of using the same technique of including the prices of externalities like recycling, water energy used for production, the impact on climate change, cleaning the oceans, into the price of plastic?
It's a great idea.
Yay! How do we implement that?
So that is happening. In Europe, you have a number of what we call these extended producer responsibility or EPR schemes, where companies do have to pay a fee for every, you know, per ton of different materials that they put onto the market. And that fee goes towards waste management of those different materials. And in a perfect world, it's not often the case, but in theory, you can change that fee according to how hard each material is to recycle. So a very difficult to recycle material would have a very high fee associated with it, which obviously encourages the businesses to shift away from that material. And that those extended producer responsibility schemes where producers are actually expected to pay a fee for every ton of material that they put onto the market. And those fees can be increased or decreased depending on how difficult it is to manage those different materials. That obviously incentivizes companies to move away from the expensive materials and towards materials that don't attract a fee. So that's the kind of the externality cost is essentially in that fee. That's what's happening. You see many of these schemes are operating in Europe. Some of them are starting to happen in North America, and to some extent in some African countries. South Africa is one of got a few of these schemes. But the important piece here is that you need to have not just voluntary schemes. You need to actually have mandated schemes so that everyone has to, you know, contribute, and not just a few of the kind of well-recognized companies.
Right.
And so having the policy to support it and then the mechanisms to collect the fees and use those fees for the right purposes are really important to making those systems work.
Mm-hmm.
And you also mentioned about the waste management is one of the real ways to handle this. But unfortunately, waste management does not sound very sexy for investors. So how do you think that investors can make a return on it? Or have you also thought about it, the ways in which it can be profitable for investors to get involved?
Yeah, I think that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, upstream investments are the sexy ones, the reuse schemes and finding like alternative materials that are more responsible or more sustainable than plastic. That's where a lot of investment and interest is going at the moment. And we're we're happy to see that happening. I think when it comes to kind of waste management, a lot of the investment to date is going into to recycling or new recycling alternative technologies kind of thing, which is often challenging if it's not happening in a place where you've got a kind of the whole, where you've got control over the whole system. So you need to make sure that you've got a good stream of waste coming in order to make a financial return on your plant. I think making waste management sexy is a challenge for a campaigns company. But I think, you know, recycling is probably the key piece at this point in time. Ultimately, you know, landfill management and those kind of things, I think, are likely to main kind of continue to be probably the realm of kind of government's responsibilities, and unfortunately something that the taxpayer is going to have to continue to foot until we find a way to kind of increase accountability upstream.
And John, you know, many investors are watching our TV show. Could you name a few examples of concrete waste management projects which are right now available to finance? Because some investors are also very much concerned about this topic and issue, and maybe you can help some projects to get financed.
Sure. I think there's an excellent guide that I would suggest to investors to look at. It's called Reuse. It's a report by the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, which covers, I think, about 200 different innovations in the reuse space. And not all of them are necessarily looking for financing. Some of them have got great investors. But I think there are a lot of interesting companies there which are showing the way. One of the ones that, you know, I always enjoy is a company called El Gramo, which is based in Chile. And it's a refill solution where they are offering, at this point in time, like detergents and washing powder in a refill, in an electric tricycle that moves around the suburbs, and people come out with their own containers and can buy directly from the tricycle. And they've got some really cool kind of tricks built into it, you know, to how you can easily pay for it and all of that. But the challenge has been historically is that those products were sold in sachets in very small volumes, and so you had a lot of packaging per you know, kilogram of product, and the price was really high. And that's, unfortunately, these lower income consumers couldn't afford to buy in bulk. So now it's kind of unlocking two problems here. You're reducing the amount of packaging required, and you're making it cheaper because they're not having to pay for that packaging, and they can now start, you know, buying in bulk. And so, you know, El Gramo is the Chilean example, but there are quite a few other examples like that around the world. Another one kind of a bit closer to home in Europe is the Recap, which is around using coffee cups, kind of it's almost like
I know them. Yeah, they're cool.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Like a membership scheme for coffee cups, where you can get a clean cup every time you walk into the store, and then, you know, bring back an old cup that you've used, and they will clean it and hand it on to someone else. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the kind of interesting things. There's also investment in the space of alternative materials. So looking at things like seaweed to replace some kind of applications of plastic. Maybe just a caution on that is that you have to make sure that, you know, there's a lot of interest in this kind of space of biodegradable plastics at the moment. But, you know, a lot of the promise has not been delivered on, and many of these kind of biodegradable plastics don't actually biodegrade in the ocean. So when investing in those spaces, you really need to ensure that you've actually got a product which does what it should. And then when you come to, I think, you know, waste management, like practical examples of investment in waste management, that as I said, is challenging. And most of the investment that I've seen is going into new forms of recycling. So, you know, looking at what they call chemical recycling, where you're breaking down plastic back down into its kind of original monomers so that you can basically recreate virgin plastic. But it also has challenges associated with it because it requires a lot of energy and can create some other toxins. Right. Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. Oh, we are running out of time because we wanted to also speak a little bit about the city development. But we don't have much time left. But can you say a little bit about what you are, your initiative is doing on city development?
Yeah, sure. So as I said, I think at the beginning, one of the key kind of focus areas for WWF is at a city level, because this is recognizing that waste management is typically managed at a city level. So, you know, national governments can create policy, but the people who are actually responsible for collecting the fees and the actual waste are typically kind of, you know, municipalities. And municipalities often, it happens behind the scenes and people don't really think enough about it. So the challenge there is really bringing in multiple actors to understand, you know, how we can have a holistic system-wide approach. We're working through the Plastic Smart Cities approach with 25 pilot cities in Southeast Asia. So in Indonesia.
25 pilot cities, wow.
Okay. Yeah, but I mean, there are over 10,000 cities around the world. So we what we want to do is...
I know. But we need to start somewhere, right?
Yeah, that's it. It's really a pilot. The goal is to show what is possible. And you know, so we're working in Philippines, Thailand, Indonesia, Vietnam, and China to try and, you know, work. If we can get it right in some of those areas, then I think there's real hope that we can scale that both across Southeast Asia, but the rest of the world. And, you know, and that's a holistic approach, saying actually, well, let's first understand what the problem is. Let's map the problem, and then not leave it all to the municipality to solve. You know, bring in corporates where can they actually address it? Where can we actually eliminate plastics to start with? And you know, all of this hopefully from a science-based perspective, because often you only start thinking about it once the waste is created. And if you start a little bit higher up and say, well, actually, what could we, how we could reduce, like an organic waste is actually, to come back to your question earlier, Sveta, investing in organic waste is really interesting, because if you can, in places like China, 60% of the waste stream is made up of organic waste. Mm-hmm. And there's actually our financial opportunities around organic waste for, you know, fertilizer and biogas, all of these things. And if you can get that organic waste out of the waste stream, that means that you like halve the waste stream, but you also make sure that the remaining waste stream is more recyclable because it's not contaminated. So you can increase recycling levels of the plastics in the waste stream, and you can halve the amount of waste that you actually have to deal with. So that's a real opportunity, which I think, particularly in the developing world, you know, we need to be looking into much more.
Wow, John, we are really running out of time now, but of course, we have always time for a call to action. Would you share something for our global audience? What is a call to action from your side?
Well, I think you've shared it already, Sveta, but the biggest thing is where we sit right now, we have this global treaty or discussions around a global treaty happening. And we need to increase accountability of companies and countries for the plastic pollution problem. And as consumers or individual citizens, you know, and as owners of companies or investors in companies, the best thing we can do is create that foundation, that treaty that governs how, you know, what the rules of the game are, and to make sure that we're all playing by the same rules. So, you know, in WWF, we have a number of ways in which, you know, individuals can support. There's a petition that we have, over two and a bit million people have signed, calling for the treaty. There is a manifesto of over 90 different businesses around the world who are calling for that treaty, including some of the big names like, you know, Coca-Cola and Nestle and Unilever. And that also includes, I think, over $5 trillion of assets under management from the different financial institutions that are supporting it. So, you know, I would really encourage anyone who's interested to get involved in that, in those initiatives, making sure that, you know, any decision makers you know of are aware that you are supportive of a global treaty, and that, you know, come February next year, we really do get the mandate to start negotiating that treaty, because without that, we're going to continue with the kind of current trends.
Mm-hmm. John, please make sure you send us a link for this treaty, and then we will also publish it so everyone who wants can.
Yeah, I was just going to ask that.
I was quicker.
and would also these informations be available on the WWF website?
Yes. You should be able to find it on our website, but I'll also make sure you guys get the links so you can share them with your audiences.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for coming today to our show. It was amazing, very amazing insights shared. And yeah, we're looking forward to hear more in the next year or years about the development.
No, we are calling him on February to find out whether he got it through or not.
Yeah, so am I. Thanks for the opportunity. It's great.
John, please register on Chamomile as a little present. You will get upgraded membership. Just register and let us know. We will provide you a coupon to do that.
Thank you very much. Bye for now.
Thank you, John. And bye-bye.
Bye.
Dear viewers, with this, our show of today, the 12th episode of Season 3, ends. And if you liked it, please subscribe or on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/SwissImpact.
And next week, it's going to be amazing because there's an event taking place in Geneva. It's called the Building Bridges event, where the complete financial world, the political world, NGOs and United Nations is coming together to discuss about implementation of SDGs and how we are going to finance SDGs. So we will be there and we will be reporting. I'll be speaking there a couple of times and we will do a complete reporting next week about what happened in Geneva.
Yeah, so don't miss it. Subscribe and also check Chamomile if you want to learn with us. For now, thank you and act for your future.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Welcome to Season 3 of Swiss Impact with Banerjees. I'm Sveta.
And I'm Ben.
The topic of Season 3 is Impact Investing, the New Normal. Do you also want to do something meaningful for our planet and people or invest with impact?
Then our amazing and powerful guests who are business owners, heads of financial institutions, thought leaders, political leaders, policymakers, investors, and experts.
Greetings, my name is Ash Bachori and I'm the senior mentor of the POP or Protect Our Planet movement and also a member of the board and secretary treasurer of the World Sustainable Development Forum. Our primary goal is to mobilize the 1.8 billion youth of the world to urgently address the issue of climate change and take action to protect our planet.
This will inspire you to get engaged.
And in this season, we will challenge them even more to take actions towards sustainable development goals, to enable paradigm shift in the financial sector and way of doing business.
Watch and learn how can we, as humans, transform into eco-financial system which would serve all people and the environment.
We aim for impact investment to become available to anyone, become truly mainstream.
See you every Friday at 3 p.m. Central European Time at Swiss Impact with Banerjee.
Act for your future.